I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a mistrial was declared in the case of Michael Slager, the white police officer who shot unarmed black man Walter Scott in the back as he ran from a traffic stop. Scott's death was caught on a passerby's phone. Slager's original testimony that Scott grabbed his taser and was threatening him fell apart when the video surfaced. In it, Scott is clearly seen running away while Slager takes aim and... It's been 3 years since the social movement Black Lives Matter came into being. Its protests of police killings of unarmed black people has put the group at odds with police unions, incoming President Donald Trump.
When you're calling death to police and kill the police, essentially, which is what they said, that's a real big problem.
And the likes of Rush Limbaugh.
They're a terrorist group. They're quickly becoming a terrorist group committing hate crimes.
This summer, the White House rejected a petition signed by more than 141,000 people urging it to formally recognize Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group. Given the news this week of the mistrial, we thought we'd replay our July interview with Patrice Cullors, a co-founder and leading voice in the Black Lives Matter movement. We spoke to her after the deaths of five police officers at the hands of a black sniper in Dallas at a Black Lives Matter protest. I asked for her reaction to Milwaukee's black county sheriff David Clark's remarks on CNN.
This anti-cop sentiment from this hateful ideology called Black Lives Matter has fueled this rage against the American police officer.
Our movement has never called for the execution of law enforcement, never. Yet many want to place the blame at our feet. There is a historical legacy of undermining black communities who stand up and fight for our right to really be a part of this American democracy.
So tell me what Black Lives Matter does advocate.
We have a vision where ultimately law enforcement agencies will be the least prioritized for community safety. And in fact, we think community safety really looks like people's ability to have employment, our community's ability to have access to healthy food, shelter. What we've seen in the last two decades is monies being poured into law enforcement agencies, and those agencies have continued to violate the civil and human rights of black people.
Statements that condemn Black Lives Matter often are followed by, why aren't you focusing more on black-on-black crime? Here's Rudy Giuliani on CBS earlier this month.
A black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another black, which happens every 14 hours in Chicago. And we never hear from Black Lives Matter.
This conversation of black-on-black crime is a distraction from the larger conversation around how the state has allowed for our communities to be completely decimated. Let's take here in Los Angeles. 52% of the city budget goes towards law enforcement. Yet our communities in L.A. have the highest unemployment rates, the highest homeless population. We are suffering from mental health issues, from drug addiction, and yet we see resources being pulled and pulled from our communities. And so when critics start to uplift this fallacy of black-on-black crime, it's them unwilling to take a hard look at how they've contributed to the devastation in our communities.
You've been explicitly advocating for police reform, including proposals, if I have it right, like defunding the police?
Correct.
Well, that's interpreted by critics as anti-police, and from there they move to the charge that you're pro-violence against police. Obviously, that's a huge and dangerous leap.
Yes.
Is Black Lives Matter, in a sense, anti-police?
We are against the system of policing that has disenfranchised black lives. If you go into any poor community, you will see a community that is heavily policed. You will see many black people who are largely unemployed and trying to figure out how they're going to survive and feed their children. And in that poor community, you will see Black people not being able to get to school because their schools are actually funneling them to prisons.
Essentially, there are police in the schools. They get kids for minor infractions. And so it becomes a kind of corridor into the criminal justice system.
Precisely. Our call for defunding law enforcement is a common sense conversation to us. Where is money going locally, statewide, and nationally? It's going towards the law enforcement apparatus, policing, jailing, incarceration, and the in-between.
Anything cutting the budgets, the way to begin the process of shifting money in a different direction?
Yes, looking at where we then put more money. What we fail to remember is that the kind of law enforcement and policing and incarceration we see today did not exist 40, 50 years ago. This is policing on steroids. What we are asking for is our communities to have a fighting chance. We don't even have that.
A Washington Post ABC News poll recently found that a majority of Americans think race relations are getting worse. But there are also scholars of the 60s who say that the progress we've made is clear, and that, in fact, the outcry against events like the shootings of unarmed Black men is a sign of that progress. Right, in your view?
Well, Americans are often scared to be honest about social ills. And so when we start to speak honestly about them, as the protests continue, as the highways continue to shut down, instead of seeing these moments as moments to expose the realities of this country, I think people feel fearful. And so I think why scholars are saying actually this is an amazing moment is because they're looking back at history, how these types of moments actually change the course of countries and peoples. The fact that 4 years ago, Black people being killed by law enforcement was not an important conversation to have just shows you how far we've come. We are frontline news. It's terrible that it's Black death that's frontline news, but the exposure has allowed for a new vision for what Black life can actually look like. This is our moment to try to get it right so that in 30 years, my child can say, I'm living in a better world because of the work of Black Lives Matter.
One last thing, and I know you've heard this question before. It's about the phrase Black Lives Matter. It's a response to the unspoken understanding that in many instances, Black lives don't matter, at least as much as white lives. And yet it's a phrase that's been consistently and sometimes willfully misconstrued. Do you ever wish you'd come up with Black lives also matter instead?
No.
But I mean, so many people didn't get it.
And that's because we don't have honest conversations about race. I think what happened when President Obama was elected is people really believed that we had overcome. We don't have a strong understanding of institutional racism in this country. And so Black Lives Matter, the strength in that really presents a new set of conversations for the country to grapple with. And we're seeing it. I think that's special. I think this is a special time.
And you'd ruin it if you stuck in also.
At this point, yes.
At this point, absolutely. Patrice Cullors is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter. We spoke to her in July. 3 days after the killing of the police officers in Dallas this summer, another shooter took aim at the police. Gavin Long killed three officers in Baton Rouge before being shot and killed himself. If Long had survived, he would have been prosecuted under Louisiana's brand new Black Lives Matter Act, which classifies the killing of police officers as a hate crime. Florida, Wisconsin, and Kentucky have introduced similar bills, and a Black Lives Matter Act has been presented to Congress. Are the police under attack? At the Republican National Convention, Donald Trump, as per usual, weighed in with a manufactured statistic.
The number of police officers killed in the line of duty has risen by almost 50% compared to this point last year.
In fact, the number of police killed by gunfire last year was down 14% from 2014, and the average number of total deaths has steadily declined since the Reagan era. Eugene O'Donnell is a former NYPD officer and prosecutor and currently a faculty member at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Last summer, he told us that pitting black lives against blue ones does nothing to address what really ails our police force.
What we have here, which is a crisis, unreported, is in large cities, 80% of violent crime is not solved. The police now, presented with homicide cases, are giving black people, in the main, some Latino people, condolences. I find that unacceptable. Now, I could tell you forever how bad jail is, prison is, but we need something to incapacitate people that are a danger to the community. And if you walk in the city of Chicago, street by street, the south side, the west side, this is what the people in the neighborhood actually want. The one thing the country absolutely does not need is a rerunning of law and order versus the new paradigm, which is the system is racist, let's hit the shutdown button. The common thread is that poor people lose in both of those conversations and have lost now for 30 years. It's not a national crisis. The Republicans are talking junk, of course. Country is more safe by and large than it has been, but in inner cities, we got real serious issues. And they're not just people shooting. How many African American middle class people left Chicago in the South Side, the West Side, in large part because of public safety, because their needs were being ignored? Now, we have in Chicago now a police department in name only. They get there when they get there. And if you hear the cops talk, they say, be fetal, stay fetal. Don't do anything at all. Which is cruel because in the African-American community, this has been a dual complaint. The cops are either brutal or feckless. There's no in-between. And that's where the conversation needs to be.
I know you're skeptical of the idea of community policing. Do you see that as a solution of any kind, or do you see any solutions? Where do we begin?
Well, I hate to say this, but we have a failed political system and a soon-to-be failed police system. It's hard to get people to vote. It's hard to get people engaged. Doubly hard for poor people that are just struggling to make ends meet. So when you talk about community policing, you're going to have big cities where community policing is good for the cops because they don't have to do patrol. It's most often used in the aftermath of a crisis. You know, I hate to be dismissive because certainly with an Eric Garner case on Staten Island, that to me was a case for community policing. I mean, you don't need to dedicate the whole agency to this. If you could have in each neighborhood a couple of cops well-known in the neighborhood who can use their soft power to go out and to try to negotiate people off the corners that are causing problems that are of concern. But this, again, is the rub with the police. The police have, in part, a conflictive adversarial role. So everybody likes community policing because it implies that policing is never conflictive or adversarial. And the fact is, there are people that bully whole neighborhoods, people that show utter disregard for whole neighborhoods, and you get repeated complaints. And we have an elite of people living in doorman condominiums saying, that's okay for them, but it wouldn't be okay for us.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of issues you have to navigate. But the problem is, in a lot of the communities, you'll see a neighborhood of 130,000 people and five of the same faces there. The idea that you're going to get a large cadre of people that are going to be so invested, especially now. If you go back years ago in the 70s, I think, well, the neighborhood police team in Harlem, which was very effective, but there was more engagement. You had the churches. You had a lot of people that you could connect into. Still have some of that, but let's face it, our democracy is in danger here. And people offering no solutions get center stage. Almost predictably, when you try to get at the solutions, the conversation ends with the press. Because the pyrotechnics is what's exciting. And there are no magic solutions, but there are some solutions.
Tell me what you think some of them might be.
Well, I mean, the President's Commission last year, and it should have been big news, didn't even try to suggest what the Kerner Commission said 50 years ago, which is every cop should have a four-year degree.
Mm-hmm.
They would be laughed out if they did that now. 99% of the nation's police departments do not have a four-year requirement. Cities that had a modest go to college for some credits requirement have been forced to drop that requirement as the recruiting pools shrink and shrink and shrink. Just getting ambulatory people to do the job is a challenge. And again, the elite thinks it's not a skilled job. It's an incredibly skilled job. And renowned media outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, This is a topic they don't spend any time on because it is really is an elitist outlook. Some knucklehead will be desperate enough, they'll take the job, and we can write 475 editorials criticizing those people.
I wonder then, do you agree with what the Dallas police chief said?
Not enough mental health funding. Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding. Let's give it to the cops. Here in Dallas, we got a loose dog problem. Let's have the cops chase loose dogs. You know, schools fail. Give it to the cops. 70% of the African American community is being raised by single women. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. That's too much to ask.
The police become the representative of the government of first contact and last resort.
Is there any doubt that the political system has failed, that they're in absentia on the ground where they're most needed? Is there anything more depressing? This is a human issue. It's an American issue. We got kids, you know, in Chicago that fought for the country. They're veterans. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, can't we find some urgency?
So what you're saying is we need to allocate more resources for these communities, more opportunities for people to build their lives.
You know, in the 10 cities in the country that are most heavily affected with this, how do we take off our partisan hats and come up with solutions, job training, you know, improvement in the schools? I mean, the picture is bleak. And the decline in the labor movement, the decline in middle-class jobs, the postal service, public transit. I mean, there were so many places where people, white and black, had access to employment. They were homeowners. They were able to pay the bills. They were able to retire someday. This is not lost on the younger generation. They know there's no plan for them at all, not even a pretense, neither party. You know, we're talking about the inner city, but increasingly it's well documented here. This is a white and black issue also. And real reform, I think, has to be premised on the notion the police role is going to be shrunk. It's going to have to be shrunk just because of the numbers, but it also has to be shrunk because we're overtasking the police, overasking the police. And something like deadly force, it's really hard to simultaneously send the cops into harm's way and micromanage their interactions. It's just a very hard fix. And this is where Black Lives Matter. I get Black Lives Matter because as a prosecutor, I investigated police shootings, and it was always a concern. We want to make sure that the police are only shooting when there's no other choice. And there are definitely shootings that are legally justifiable, but are not necessary. That might sound bizarre, but under our system, mm-hmm. because the police have so much power, they can shoot even though it's not absolutely necessary. So what does that tell you? Well, I understand the black community, if you look and all the victims seem to be black, that doesn't seem to equate to their lives mattering in the justice system.
Where you and Patrice seem to entirely agree is that the focus has to be on those neighborhoods, on those schools, on the housing, jobs that offer you a handhold into the middle class.
But that conversation is dead on arrival. The notion of a government job program, that the government has some responsibility, that's off the table. Congress is not going to do that. And I don't think this has to be terribly expensive, but we have 8 or 10 cities. We should make it a laboratory. How do we find those programs that work the best and replicate them where they're most needed? And the other thing that just is so obvious here, the federal government has to have a role here. That's what's been missing. You cannot say to Camden, New Jersey, or even Philadelphia, you know, go fix this. There has to be federal money on the table. And again, the depressing thing is it's not seeable. And what's also further depressing, you know, I could say it because the Republicans are saying it at their convention. There's this apocalyptic 1968, the cities are going to burn rhetoric hanging right out there. And when you had that the last time, that scared people into acting. This was self-preservation. That I don't see now at all. You almost get the impression some people wouldn't mind a great unraveling.
Eugene, thank you very much.
Sure.
Eugene O'Donnell is a former NYPD officer and now on the faculty of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. This was an OTM Podcast Extra. Thanks for listening.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.